Today at Reader's Corner, Jonathan Katz, author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On a hot January afternoon in 2010, reporter Jonathan Katz heard a loud rumbling outside his home in the hills above Port-au-Prince, Haiti. At first, he thought it was a water truck. Then the bed began to vibrate. Bottles shimmied on a nearby table and the floor started to move. The roar increased as the deadliest earthquake in the history of the Western Hemisphere unleashed its full force. Mr. Katz survived. Thousands upon thousands of others were not so lucky. Jonathan Katz tells the story of the earthquake and its complicated aftermath in The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. The book, now out in paperback, has won many honors, including the Overseas Press Club of America's prize for the year's best book on international affairs. In 2011, Mr. Katz was awarded the prestigious Medill Medal for Courage in Journalism for his work in Haiti. He now works as a freelance journalist covering international and domestic affairs. This is not the first time we've discussed the Haiti earthquake on this program. In 2010, I spoke with Boise State French professor Jason Herbick, who had just returned home after experiencing the disaster firsthand. Dr. Herbeck was staying at a hotel near Port-au-Prince, not far from Mr. Katz's home, when the quake struck. Thankfully, he was not injured. His description of the quake and its immediate aftermath, including the lack of looting, mirrors some of the observations Mr. Katz makes in his book, and I'm looking forward to our conversation today. Mr. Katz joins us from the studios of Radio Art in Manhattan. Jonathan Katz, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Well, Jonathan, this really is quite a tale you've told, and I guess we really ought to just start with the basics of this disaster and how horrible it was. How many died as a result of the earthquake alone, not taking into account the cholera disaster, which we'll talk about later?
Sure. Well, actually, nobody knows exactly how many people died. It's frankly more than anybody had the capacity to count. Frankly, nobody knew how many people were living in the Port-au-Prince metro area or the other cities that were affected by the earthquake before it struck in the first place. But the estimates are between 100,000 on the low end and 316,000 on the high end. That's the government estimate. And if that high end estimate is right, it would basically be about 1 in 10 people who lived in the area that the earthquake struck were killed by the disaster.
And the size of the earthquake, the seismic size of the earthquake, and then the size of the aftershocks and the number of aftershocks, please explain that.
Sure. Well, on the magnitude moment scale, which is what earthquakes are measured on. By the way, it's not the Richter scale. That hasn't been used for a very long time. But it's a similar scale called the magnitude moment scale. It ranked a 7.0, which is a moderate size earthquake. I mean, people who live in seismically active areas like, say, Southern California would recognize a 7.0 as being bad, but not nearly as bad as higher numbers up the logarithmic scale. But the thing that doesn't fully capture is how close it hit to major populated area, exactly what the ground type was. If you look at the maps that the U.S. Geological Survey did after the earthquake, they measure not only the magnitude of the earthquake itself, but the force of the shaking. And the shake map for the Haiti earthquake in 2010 is about as bad as anyone that you'll ever see. Essentially, it was the maximum amount of shaking in areas that had the maximum amount of people, and those people were living in homes that were not built up to any kind of standard or any kind of code, which is why it turned out to be so devastating. Mm-hmm. And of course, in any earthquake that's of any reasonable size, including a 7.0, you're going to get tons of aftershocks, and those continued for days and weeks and in some cases even years. Sometimes when there's a small tremor in Haiti or in the Dominican Republic, other places along that fault line now, seismologists say that it actually still may be an aftershock of the earthquake.
Did the aftershocks actually cause more people to die, or are those just those? I mean, I've been in earthquakes, mild ones, and of course the aftershock is just something that scares the wits out of you, but it doesn't do as much harm as the first one.
Well, certainly nothing was as big as the initial shock. That's really the only definition of an aftershock. The difference between an earthquake and an aftershock is just size. Another shock that comes after the initial earthquake is larger, then they just reclassify the original earthquake as a foreshock. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to say. I mean, in the first couple of days after the big one, There were some pretty heavy aftershocks, one of which was measured at a 6.1, and then it, I think, was revised down to a 5.9. And it's pretty certain that that did additional damage. But again, since nobody knows even exactly how many people died, nobody can really categorize exactly how people died. It's hard to say exactly how many of those died in the initial shock and in those first 40 seconds, died of their injuries soon thereafter, and then how many of those injuries would have been exacerbated or maybe even caused by some of the aftershocks. Mm-hmm. They weren't pleasant. I can tell you that from having been there myself. Mm-hmm. But it's just absolutely very mm-hmm. difficult to say.
Well, tell us about your own experience. You were at home in a rented house that AP provided. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, it was it was a slow time. It was, January 12th. It was 4:53 in the afternoon. And, basically in Haiti, especially in Haiti in 2010, it was coming off of years of major political unrest. There had been a coup d'etat that had overthrown the president in 2004, and fighting between United Nations peacekeepers and partisans of the former president and the rebels who overthrew him and wanted to take power themselves had continued until just a couple years before. There had even been major riots in 2008. And so by the time you get to early 2010, it's a relatively calm time. It just felt like nothing was going on. Christmas had just passed. Carnival hadn't quite started yet. And so we were just sort of sitting and marking time, and I was getting ready to actually go and get on a flight the next day to fly up to the northern part of the country to do a story about orphanages there. And at 4:53 in the afternoon, I'm sitting on the bed. I was chatting with a friend. I was playing a game on a website called Sporkle.com, which is basically like a trivia site. Then all of a sudden, the sound started coming in from the window right across the bedroom from me. And I thought, like a lot of people did, that it might just be a truck pulling up. I mean, around that time of day is when the water truck might come. But the weird thing was that the sound was coming from the wrong side. And then it occurred to me that, maybe this was an earthquake. Maybe it was something more serious. But I stood up on the floor, and initially I didn't feel anything. And then I started feeling the rumbling, and then pretty quickly the major shocks hit, and the house started shaking violently, and waves started going through the floors, and everything started falling down around me.
And you had a fixer. If you could explain to us, first of all, what a fixer is, Evans, how do you pronounce his name?
Evans Sanon.
Evans Sanon was your fixer, and you and he basically took off. Tell us what you did for the first couple of days of that earthquake experience.
Well, I mean, time moved very, very slowly. I mean, looking back on the disaster itself, it was, each second feels like a chapter unto itself. And then, it was a matter of getting out of the house. Just to explain what Evans does, this is a very important part of journalism that a lot of readers and listeners I don't think know about, which is that there are people like Evans out there in the world who they essentially act as tour guides, interpreters, both in terms of interpreting language and interpreting culture. They are journalists themselves, sometimes in formal ways and sometimes informal ways. And they help gather information. Sometimes they're also photographers. And so what Evan's job was basically was to, he drove the car and he translated, especially in the years before I learned to speak Creole myself. But he really was sort of my eyes and ears on the ground. I depended on him for a lot of reporting and just for a lot of my life in Haiti. And I really owe him my life because when the earthquake struck, he was able to use the excellent senses that he had developed over years of observing as a fixer and noticed that there was a little bit of mortar falling out from between these kind of creek stone walls that were on the first floor of our house. That he saw falling out. And so he stood up and he walked outside. And right then the wall collapsed on the desk where he had been sitting. And then despite the fact that aftershocks were still roiling the ground, he actually ran back into the house to see if I was okay and then talked me down and got me down out of the stairs. I can't express how much I owe him for having done that.
And you actually accompanied him as he tried to search for his family.
Yeah, that's right. You know, he had a family, he had a step family, he had loved ones. His mother were all in the quake zone, and so for basically as soon as we could run back into the house and get some stuff, and I had been able to get a hold of a BlackBerry, and I called in the initial report of the earthquake, which is the initial report that went around the world. And when we were able to load up the car and start driving, it was sort of a mix of going to places to look for the people that Evans was concerned about while I was, gathering information. But because the disaster was so pervasive, it kind of didn't matter where we went. Evans at one point, apologized for detouring us to go check on his family. And I said, don't worry, man. Everything that we're seeing here is work tonight.
Now, you were scheduled to leave, and what were you going to do, go to Afghanistan? Was that your next assignment?
Yeah, I like easy assignments, so Afghanistan was going to be my next one.
So did the AP turn that around and say, Jonathan, sorry, but you're the only guy there. We need you to stay. Is that what happened?
Honestly, I don't even think a conversation was necessary.
I mean, as a report.
Yeah, I mean, when a story like that hits, I mean, the minute the earthquake hit, and of course, I didn't realize this. Well, I guess I shouldn't say the minute the earthquake hit, because it probably took about 24 hours for people outside of Haiti to really start grasping what had happened. But this was the biggest story that had happened on that beat for a very, very long time. I mean, it eclipsed the coup d'état in 2004. It maybe even eclipsed the U.S. invasion in the mid 90s. It was pretty clear that this was the biggest story that anybody who covers Haiti had covered for a very long time. So, as a journalist, despite the fact that it was not a pleasant place to be, I realized at one point while we were driving around, I thought, maybe I should get out of here. Like, I don't know what's happening, and my house is gone, and maybe it's a short drive to the Dominican border. Maybe I can get over the border and get to Santo Domingo and fly out of here. And basically, as soon as I had that thought, I realized that if I wasn't there at that moment, I would be trying as hard as I possibly could to get in there. So no, there was no way I was leaving. They really had to drag me out even to take an R&R.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Jonathan Katz, the author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Well, when I look at the book and I see the New York Times Magazine piece and I see the Atlantic piece that you did in February on the new president, this thing has substantially changed your life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be impossible to go through an event like the earthquake in Haiti without it changing your life. It changed everybody's life in some way who encountered it. It definitely set me on a course that I wouldn't have and couldn't have predicted before.
And I didn't mention the most important part. You met your wife in the middle of this disaster.
This is true. That is the most important part.
That's right.
Yeah. No, that's what happened. Yeah. Her name's Claire Payton, and she was working on a oral history project. She was getting her PhD in history and decided after the earthquake that the way she wanted to respond was by going and bringing a digital recorder and talking to earthquake survivors, of which I happened to be one. And yes, that's how we met. Sometimes there's silver linings in tragedy, and that was definitely the big one for me.
So the subtitle of your book, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster, let's start at the beginning of the disaster, which is the emergency relief. First of all, you point out in your book that these non-governmental organizations, NGOs as we call them, the NGOs were very fearful of giving the money over to the Haitian government. Help us understand the history of the NGO relationship with Haiti, the corruption and incompetence that past administrations demonstrated, and the reason why there was such fear that if we send this money into Haiti, it's going to be wasted.
Well, I think the most important thing to understand is that non-governmental organizations, NGOs, what are usually colloquially referred to just as aid groups, they're not standalone entities. They are implementers of policy, and they are part of much larger political and social dynamics. Okay, so the thing to understand is it's not I mean, it is to a certain extent. The NGO is not handing over the money. But what it really is are the NGO's donors who don't want the money handed over. And in some cases, those are, you know, private donors, you know, just regular people who picked up their phone and donated, you know, $10 or $15 or $20 to the organization and entrusted it to them and wanted the organization that they were donating it to actually be the one to do the work. But in a lot of cases, we're talking about major, major entities like especially the United States government, which have absolutely no interest in handing over money to an entity like the Haitian state. And it is true that there is a long history of poor governance, and certainly if you go back to the dictatorship of François Duvalier, who's known as Papa Doc, and his son Jean-Claude Duvalier, who's known as Baby Doc, there was definitely a lot of corruption in their time, although they did, by the way, often have the support of the United States government at various points along the way. But really, it has less to do, honestly, with actual fear, like actual fear that the United States government feels about what would happen to money if they handed it over to an entity like the Haitian state, and more just a complete lack of interest in handing over money because money is power. And when you hand power over to somebody else, that is in many cases, in most cases, power that you are taking away from yourself and giving to somebody else. And people just don't want to do that. So it was much easier, and it always is much easier, for the United States government, for the governments of Europe, for you know the major members of the United Nations, to just keep money in their own pockets to pass it from one hand to another instead of handing it over to anyone else. And then when things go wrong, as that process often does, it then becomes very easy for them to just blame it on the government that they didn't give the money to. And then the next time that there's a disaster, they can just point back to that again and use that as justification to do things the same way they did it in the first place.
In the meantime, you point out that of the nearly $1 billion in U.S. government contracts for post-quake Haiti, a very small percentage of that really went to Haitian firms. And in the meantime, you have a couple of paragraphs in your book where you're talking about the U.S. Navy burning through money that they spent on photo and video equipment in Manhattan, of all places, the Coast Guard using a Haiti contract to buy medals and ribbons. What were the medals and ribbons for? To decorate somebody for being there or what?
For themselves. The Coast Guard spent $11,000 to buy medals and ribbons to congratulate itself on a job well done in Haiti. And that money, which is fine, right? I mean, like you send military personnel out somewhere to do something. Often they expect some kind of decoration when they get back. That decoration costs money. But the thing that people have to keep in mind is that money, those $11,000, are counted as earthquake relief. So, I mean, rather, in cases like those, rather than looking at it as maybe money being stolen, I think it would be better looked at as money that essentially never existed for the purpose that people imagined. Because those $11,000 were never going to Haiti. Those $11,000, for the medals and ribbons. If you look at the grand sum of humanitarian spending in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, there was 93% of the money that was spent never left the hands of the donor countries themselves or the parts of the International Federation of Societies of Red Cross and Red Crescent. And of that money, very, very little of it would have ever actually gone to directly to the earthquake survivors themselves. What it really is that in lieu of doing any kind of serious handing over of money, that money gets spent in the donor countries and within the United Nations system and within the Red Cross system and then is just claimed later or I guess while it's going on to be aid money so that people who are watching from the outside and not really following what's going on can imagine that it's relief money. But it's not relief money. It's something else.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Katz about his book, The Big Truck That Went By. The book is a firsthand account of the deadliest quake in the history of the Western Hemisphere and its devastating aftermath. I think you said that there was the Red Cross alone had $486 million in post-quake emergency relief that they couldn't even spend. And I think in that particular situation, it was because there was no one there to handle it, to implement it, to manage it. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah, well, so it's the American Red Cross. So first of all, so back in 2004 when the tsunami hit in the Indian Ocean on December 26th, I was a reporter in Washington, D.C., and I was watching the images on CNN like everybody else, and I felt moved to do something. And so I went to what I considered to be the Red Cross, and I sent the Red Cross $20. What I didn't think about then and what I think most people didn't really think about when the earthquake struck in Haiti in 2010 and maybe still don't think about now is that that American part of American Red Cross is not – that's not just like a throwaway descriptor. That is the United States chapter of the Red Cross. So when the American Red Cross, when the Red Cross based in Washington, D.C. gets $486 million to spend in Haiti, and there is a Haitian Red Cross, which is another entity. It's a different entity that was not getting this $486 million. This money is going to the American Red Cross. The American Red Cross itself had very few personnel on the ground, very talented. I mean, they're friends of mine. I know the people who were there. They're very smart. They're very talented. They're very dedicated to their work, but there were only a couple of them. There weren't a lot of people to implement that. But frankly, there wasn't $486 million of work for the American Red Cross to do. There wasn't $486 million worth of work that the American Red Cross was capable of doing. And the American Red Cross knows that. They know that full well. But they're so, frankly, addicted to raising money because it's what their organization is devoted to. People are hired into the American Red Cross. Dozens of people's jobs at the American Red Cross are to – maybe most people's jobs at the American Red Cross are to figure out how to get people to donate money and to keep donating money. And so when there's an emergency, they continue doing what they know how to do, which is continuing to raise money. But there was some money that they could spend, but there was never anywhere near that amount of money that they could spend in any reasonable amount of time. Organizations that are frankly more responsible, and one big example in Haiti was Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders. They capped the amount of money that they were willing to raise in the name of the Haitian earthquake. I think it was 30 million euro or something like that. They said, this is the maximum amount of money that we think that we can spend. And if you want to give us more money after that, we'll very happily take it. And you can discuss whether that's a good or a bad thing. But you cannot give it to us in the name of the Haiti earthquake, because this is the maximum amount of money that we can use. And I think more responsible non-governmental organizations or aid groups than the American Red Cross have been willing to do that in the past. And I think we're seeing more of that now than we did at the time of the Haiti quake.
I guess that does raise the question of whether or not anything was learned in Haiti and will be applied in future disasters.
One short answer is yes, okay, because – and it was – you know, even at the time that I wrote the book, it was certainly the time that I was trying to get the book published. It was a very controversial proposition, right, to say that the world had come to save Haiti and left behind a disaster, that the response was a failure. I think that now and maybe not within about a year of the book's publication, that realization started creeping through and started becoming kind of the mainstream narrative. And so now Haiti's used as a sort of cautionary tale. And I think that when a disaster does strike, the earthquake in Ecuador being a small example because it was nowhere near the scale of the disaster, Nepal, which was almost exactly a year ago, the earthquake that struck there. I think that Haiti is used as a negative example, an example of things to avoid. The thing is, the thing that's frustrating about it is that a lot of these lessons that were learned or supposedly learned from the experience of the response to the earthquake in Haiti were lessons that we already knew. I mean, if you go back and you listen to Hillary Clinton's speech, she was Secretary of State at the time, and she, along with her husband, the former president, Bill Clinton, and the president of Haiti and the Secretary General of the UN, sat at the front of the room of the donors conference a couple months after the earthquake that raised pledges, which is not the same as money, but got pledges of $10 billion, quote unquote, for relief of the Haiti earthquake. And if you look at her speech that she gave, she said all of the right things. She talked about working with and through the Haitian government instead of working around it. She talked about learning from the past in all kinds of different ways. But when the rubber actually met the road, to use a cliche, these decisions were actually being made in real time, and of course they'd been being made for about 3 months before that happened, it wasn't very different from the past. So it's hard to say. there are a lot of very hard lessons that I think were reinforced, but whether the knowledge of those lessons is actually going to change the way that people react to disaster in the future is still yet to be said, and frankly is up to all of us as individuals and as citizens.
Mm-hmm. Well, if that isn't frustrating enough, then let's turn to the other side of this disaster, because as it turns out, there was a cholera breakout, an epidemic. And if you could help us understand how the UN played a significant role, and more specifically, the troops from Nepal.
Sure. So the first thing to understand is that when a disaster strikes like an earthquake, there's often a lot of talk. And you will often read news articles and you'll hear people talking about the threat of a disease outbreak. Those people are wrong. Those articles are wrong. There is, especially after a geophysical disaster like an earthquake, it is very unlikely that you're going to get any kind of follow-on disease epidemic. And you are certainly never going to get an epidemic of a disease that didn't exist in the country at the time of the disaster. And there had never been a documented case of cholera in Haiti ever at the time of the earthquake in January 2010, nor was there in February, nor March, nor April, nor May, nor June, nor July, nor August, nor September. It wasn't until October of 2010, 9 months after, in a completely different part of the country, in an area that was not affected by the earthquake, that cholera emerged for the first time ever recorded in Haiti. And within a couple weeks of the outbreak, I followed rumors that were going around Haiti, and I went up to a United Nations base at a tributary into the Artibonite River, which is the most important river system in Haiti. And I went up there not knowing what I was going to find. The United Nations the night before had put out a statement saying that it was impossible that cholera, which is a disease that is basically caused by the contamination of water or food by human waste, and by human waste containing specifically the cholera bacteria. The United Nations was saying that it's impossible that it could have happened because the sanitation at that base was up to code, and it was impossible. I got there, and it was immediately apparent that the United Nations was lying. The sanitation at the base was horrific. There were open pits of waste. There were leaks, pipes leaking toward the river. Once the soldiers saw that I was there looking around, they started digging up the pipe and calling in trucks to start empty out the septic tanks that were overflowing. So it was very clear. Oh, and by the way, the other thing was I ran into United Nations peacekeepers from the mission in Port-au-Prince taking samples of water that they could take back and test themselves quietly for cholera. So it was very clear that the United Nations was aware that something was going on. But the UN has continued for nearly 6 years now, for 5.5 years, covering up what it did. The disease was the scientific evidence is at this point irrefutable. There's a preponderance of it that the disease was brought from Nepal, where there was an active outbreak of cholera, the exact same strain, introduced into a sparsely populated part of Haiti that, again, was outside of the earthquake zone. This had nothing to do with the earthquake. And moved down the Artibonite River, and to date has killed 10,000 people. 800,000 have been infected. There are a lot of people that think those numbers are wild undercounts. And the international community has done some things to respond, but the main thing that's needed to do to eradicate the disease is the same thing that eradicated cholera in other parts of the world, including the United States, which is the construction of water and sanitation infrastructure. And they aren't willing to do so. So lawyers representing several thousand of the 10,000 people, again, 10,000 people have died of this. I've sued the United Nations, and that case is actually now moving through United States federal court, which is also unprecedented. So that may be the way that the members of the UN system, including the United States, are forced to pay to clean up the disaster that they created. But it's a good example of how the international community actually violates its principle, or violates the principle of first do no harm, and can actually do things that can cause an enormous amount of damage. And yet it's often tempting to sort of sit back and just assume that it's these other countries, these impoverished countries that are basket cases that create their own problems, and we come in to save them, when often we actually come in and do quite considerable damage.
Well, we've run out of time on today's program, but next week we'll continue our conversation with Jonathan Katz about his book, The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Jonathan, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Paul Cox. Research by Brady Moore. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to previous shows anytime, download our free player from the iTunes App Store. Search for Reader's Corner.